Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
Buenas tardes, damas y caballeros.
It's nice to see so many of you still with me. I'm not sure whether you have been before or not, but each time I try to give a lecture which is in a way self-contained and at the same time to expand the knowledge of those of you who are so faithful that you keep on coming. On Thursday, I'm going to give you my pièce de résistance, a special lecture on, I think, really the religious aspects in a new way, different from the first time that I showed, that I did when I gave my first lecture. But today I'm talking about heroes and hero worship, and with some reference to the idea of the idol or idol, which is a pastoral form of literature, which has also got elements of the heroic in it. Can we have the first slide? This is Thomas Carlyle. Thomas Carlyle is really the keystone, the centerpiece of the whole of this lecture, because it was he who in 1840 gave a series of lectures on the idea of the hero in history. I want to suggest to you from the beginning something which is quite obvious to all of us who are interested in politics and the way in which societies are organized, and that is the relation of the individual to the society in which he or she lives. Now, of course, Carlyle was someone who believed absolutely in the idea of the individual as hero. And this particular image of him, I think, shows that if he held this opinion, it didn't necessarily make him a completely happy man. It's a marvelous picture, I think, like the first picture, marvelous picture of Carlyle also. But it shows him to be, I think, a man with a very dark side to his nature. He's quite a frightening-looking person. Anna Jameson, who I referred to in my first lecture, that wonderful Scotswoman who did the first histories of Christian iconography in England, thought that Carlyle was... She described him as someone with a very bright intelligence, an extremely hard kind of mind, which could show its light quite strongly on an object in front of it, but didn't have much general passage of light all around it. In other words, he was a man with a very strong, determined look in his eye, which rather made him someone who was rather intolerant of other opinions. And this, of course, is one of the problems of individualism, which, of course, can become egoism all too easily. But Carlyle was certainly, for Julia Margaret Cameron, one of her heroes. In 1859, she did something really quite extraordinary. She gave Tennyson as presents that year various books. One of the books was John Stuart Mill, the English libertarian writer, John Stuart Mill's book called On Liberty. 10 years later, in 1869, he wrote another book called On the Subjection of Women. Subjection, to hold women down. On the holding down of women, the repression of women. And I've often wondered about Julia Margaret Cameron's own position with regard to the status of women in the 19th century, surrounded by heroic male figures. Sir Henry Taylor, Julia Margaret Cameron's best friend, did a review in one of the magazines of John Stuart Mill's On the Subjection of Women, and he found Mill's opinion too liberal. That's to say, John Stuart Mill was suggesting that women should have the right to vote, and so on. And Sir Henry Taylor was not convinced. Now, if Sir Henry Taylor was Mrs. Cameron's best friend, then, of course, they must have discussed these subjects. And it's this theme of the relation between the individual in society and women in society which I wish to touch upon tonight. John Stuart Mill on Liberty, that was one book. The latest translation of the Mort d'Arthur, as it's called in English, La Mort d'Arthur, one of the French romances, as translated first into English in the 15th century by Sir Thomas Malory, but translated in different versions by all the great English poets through the centuries, and finally by Tennyson in 1859. Just when Tennyson was working on his Idylls of the King, meaning King Arthur, Mrs. Cameron decided to give him the best and most beautiful edition of the original Malory, Mort d'Arthur. So you see, Mrs. Cameron is someone who is very alert to what is important. The third book that she gave him was a book by the great English woman writer who had a man's name. That's to say, she wrote under a nom de plume, and that was George Eliot. George Eliot published a book called Adam Bede that year in 1859, and Juliet Margaret Cameron, knowing what was good for Tennyson, gave it to him as a present. And the fourth book, well, the fourth book was the second volume of Carlyle's History of Frederick the Great of Prussia. So there, that's the kind of woman she was, that's how much she read, that's what she would recommend to Tennyson, and it suggests that actually she had a very firm grasp of what I call the theme of the heroic individual, Frederick the Great, King Arthur. But then two other books, one on liberty and one, the one by George Eliot on Adam Bede, which shows for the first time, perhaps, in English literature, the very subtle relations between men and women and the kinds of difficulties that they have in terms of a power structure. Next, please. Next slide. Sir John Herschel, our familiar friend, the inventor, part inventor of photography, the astronomer, here depicted, I think, as the priest, as I've suggested before, one of Julia Margaret Cameron's closest friends, who, as I said before, engaged with her on matters of theological controversy. And, of course, insofar as he was someone who was deeply religious, as well as being a scientist, he must have taken the conventional view, perhaps, of the position of women in society. Next, please. Here he is as less the priest, more the hero. And the kind of hero that he is, I think, is the hero as philosopher. Carlyle described various kinds of hero. The hero as lawmaker or legislator, the hero as natural philosopher or scientist, as philosopher, meaning classical philosophy, the hero as warrior. And there, of course, we would think of King Arthur, the warrior king of the early times of England. But here we have Sir John Herschel as, I believe, the Newtonian philosopher, the 18th century philosopher, looking passionately out into the dark night sky and dealing with the problems of existence as a scientist. The word scientist, by the way, was only invented in the English language in the 1840s. Before that, everyone was called a natural philosopher. I think it's a great pity that we lost the term natural philosopher in favor of that rather mechanistic notion of the scientist. Poets and scientists would still be friends if we were all called natural philosophers. Next, please. This is the man that stood as the guarantee of the settlement of Julia Margaret Cameron's marriage in India in 1838. He was a family friend, not important, not a hero, but there is another kind of hero who appears in Mrs. Cameron's work, and that, I think, is the hero we might describe as the saint. The saint, or in other forms, of course, the holy man, the abbot, as we will see in Tennyson. But here, actually, I think we have, in this old family friend, the character in the Christian story who I always feel somewhat sorry for, and that is Joseph, the father, as it were, of Jesus. And this figure, with the halo drawn by hand, perhaps on the print when it's still wet, I don't know how she did it, but here I think we have Henry Princep, as he was called, as Joseph. And of course, this is a way by which you can make a man a hero. You can raise him by actually portraying him in the person of a biblical character. Next, please. Anna Jameson, I've mentioned already, this Scottish historian of art, who in her book, The Sacred and Legendary in Art, made this illustration of St. Paul and St. Peter. And here you have, if you like, the hero as the apostle, or the hero as evangelist. Next, please. In this particular case, this is the painter of the portraits in oils which are in the exhibition, George Frederick Watts. The title of the picture is The Whisper of the Muse. And you can see the girl on the top right is probably whispering somewhere near his ear. In other versions of this picture, she has her mouth close to his ear, but this is the one which I have on slide. In the exhibition, her head is much closer to his ear. Next, please. And you'll see where it comes from. It's Rembrandt with the woman or the angel or the muse whispering in the ear of St. Matthew as he writes the Gospel of St. Matthew, of course. So you see, the context in which Mrs. Cameron is working is always religious, and yet, of course, St. Matthew is a heroic figure in the sense that he is one of the four evangelists, one of the great men of biblical literature. Next, please. Tennyson wearing what I think I might call a Reformation cap. Now, of course, in the Reformation, with Protestantism, we get a degree of secularism, and Christianity in its unified form takes some blows. But I'm sure that there were ways by which we could in fact reincorporate the Reformation into the great tradition of heroic figures from the Bible by putting Tennyson in the position of a saint. Next, please. Next, please. If you've been to the Prado, you will have seen this picture. I hope you've been to the Prado. I go nearly every day now I'm here in Madrid. And today I bought this slide and I thought I would show it to you at once because St. Thomas More, the English Reformation scholar who was martyred for his own religious beliefs by that wicked and villainous character, Henry VIII, here he is, St. Thomas More, wearing the same kind of cap, essentially, as the one that Tennyson wears and Sir Henry Taylor wears. It's by Rubens, and it's in your Prado. Next, please. And here is Sir Henry Taylor wearing something like that cap. And Taylor, this is the man that I've described as Julia Margaret Cameron's best intellectual friend, the one who wrote this somewhat critical review of John Stuart Mill's paper on the subjection of women. And it's interesting to speculate, to imagine how Mrs. Cameron intended us to see this character and what kind of a hero Sir Henry Taylor was. He was a playwright, very well known in the 1840s, who wrote a play with a Dutch title, the name of a Dutchman as its title, Philip van Arteveld. And in that play, he describes the life of a man who gives up the via contemplativa, the contemplative life, in favor of, or in following his duty to take up an active role in society, the via activa. I think it's probably autobiographical, this play by Sir Henry Taylor, because Sir Henry Taylor was a man who was a poet by nature, but who worked in the British civil service, and so far as I can tell, did good and liberal work in the field of the civil service, working on questions of the West Indies and of India and on the Irish question, and usually being on what we would call the progressive side. So I think he was some kind of a hero. If you can imagine a person, the hero as civil servant, then it would be Sir Henry Taylor. I didn't say bureaucrat, I just said civil servant. If all our bureaucrats were poets capable of writing good plays, then we would have no trouble. Next, please. Now you see, you have this in the Prado too. It's by a painter called Koninck, and the title is A Philosopher. And it's very hard to suppress the feeling that Mrs. Cameron somehow knows about this, the resemblance in the subject between her picture of Sir Henry Taylor and this is quite striking. And I saw it for the first time today, which is even more exciting, and is probably therefore unscholarly because I haven't been thinking about it long enough. But next time you go to the Prado and you see this picture, which is a different version, this is Rubens again, Heraclitus, the philosopher who is obsessed with problems of change, the flux of Heraclitus. He now, of course, is looking a slightly more troubled figure, not quite so sure of the meaning of life as he was, perhaps, as the philosopher in the studio of Koninck. Next, please. And here you see another version of him. Now, is he the philosopher, or is he another kind of hero with a very pessimistic view of life? Next, please. The Jeremiah of Michelangelo on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, one of the Arundel prints, which you find in the exhibition, which Mrs. Cameron knew because she was a subscriber to the society called the Arundel Society, which was promoting the knowledge of art in England in the 1850s and 60s. But you see, what I'm suggesting is that Mrs. Cameron is using Sir Henry Taylor's face in different ways, sometimes to suggest a degree of tranquility and strength, other times to suggest a degree of disturbance, difficulty, and preoccupation. In other words, the way we feel, but in the context always of the heroic prophet, Jeremiah, or the heroic scholar, philosopher, Heraclitus, or even the Reformation scholars, as I've described them, Tennyson, Sir Thomas More, and so on. Next, please. This too is Sir Henry Taylor, and by now I think you should be getting a little worried about how she sees him this time. Now, in some versions of this picture, the title is Prospero. Prospero is the lord and king of that magical island in Shakespeare's play The Tempest. And he rules it, this island, he rules it like a god, and a god who is not entirely a benevolent figure. He's somewhat cruel. And of course, throughout history, men have wondered whether the god that rules the universe is always on our side, such terrible things happen to us. And Prospero is seen here, I think, as a dark figure, a little like the Carlyle figure at the beginning of this series of slides. And when Sir Henry Taylor saw it, he felt what Mrs. Cameron had done. And in just the same way that Tennyson said, "Ah, I see you've made me into a dirty monk," he said, "Caesar Borgia." And if you know who Caesar Borgia was, well, he was one of the most repressive of the Italian monarchs. And of course, what Taylor is saying is, you're showing me as a tyrant, not simply as Prospero, lord and master of an island, who is arranging everything in the end for the best. Next, please. He was still wearing the Reformation cap, by the way, but it didn't seem to make any difference. This is Sir Henry Taylor in the person of Friar Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet by Shakespeare, giving the vial or little bottle which contains the sleeping potion which will send Juliet to sleep until she's reunited with Romeo. As you know, the story doesn't work out at all well. And the best advice that any man can give to any woman is never take strange bottles of liquid from strange men. And I'm not entirely joking. But let me tell you, there's an almost identical picture without the bottle, but with the same relationship of the figures, with the same dress. And this has as its title, Prospero and Miranda. So that you see, what Mrs. Cameron is doing is saying that this heroic figure, the man who rules the island, Prospero, or in this case, Friar Lawrence, the priest, the friar who is looking after the interests of the young lovers, they are somewhat sinister figures in the end. There are two sides to paternalism. There's a good side and there's a bad side. And I think Mrs. Cameron is at least subconsciously aware of this problem when she makes the pictures. Next, please. Cordelia with King Lear. This time, King Lear is played by Mrs. Cameron's own husband, Charles Cameron. He makes an extremely good King Lear. But the relation between King Lear and his daughter, if you know the play of Shakespeare, it's true that King Lear is a heroic figure, there's no doubt about it. The reason that Shakespeare's play is a tragedy is because when King Lear makes mistakes, he makes big mistakes. And he has tremendous endurance and strength to live through the sheer terror of having made those mistakes. And when he dies, we feel a great person has died. But we need to remember, you know, how it all begins. It begins because this man asks this woman if she loves him enough. The man demanding of the woman that she love him enough and more and more and more than her sisters. And this is the beginning, if you like, of the tragedy of King Lear, and it's the beginning of the repression of Cordelia on a grand scale. Next, please. This time, an Old Testament prophet, Jephthah. Jephthah and his daughter. Jephthah made a vow when he conducted his war against the Ammonites that the first person that he saw after his victory, he would sacrifice to God. Well, of course, the irony is that the first person that he sees on returning from the battlefield to his house is his own daughter standing in the doorway. And so he sacrifices his daughter. He has her put to death. because he must keep his vow in gratitude for having slain, having killed the Ammonites. But what position does this put a father in relation? How does this relate a father to the daughter? It's a type in that typological sense I was referring to in my first lecture. It's sometimes regarded as a type of the presentation of the Virgin in the temple before the birth of Christ, when the Virgin Mary is being, as it were, selected for this special privilege of bearing our Lord. But it's a heavy burden that a woman bears, and these ideas come mostly, it seems, from men of great strength and terrifying power. Next, please. Another version of the same sort of story. It looks like Henry Taylor as King David, but this time it's Henry Taylor as King Ahasuerus, who is making his daughter Esther marry someone she doesn't want to marry. A new twist on the presentation of the Virgin in the temple, a new twist on Jephthah and his daughter, a new twist on King Lear and Cordelia. In other words, all those pictures by Julia Margaret Cameron are about the relation between authority and a victim. Next, please. One of the most beautiful of all Mrs. Cameron's pictures, in my opinion. This is the one that we had on the poster for the exhibition in England. My friend who worked with me on the catalogue and did much of the difficult work of collecting all the pictures together in the right order, Sarah Selwood, this was her favourite picture and she chose it and she was right. Now, those of you who have been to my first and second lectures will know that already, just by looking at this picture, you can tell by the long hair that this woman is a type of Mary Magdalene. But the look in her eye is so beautiful and pure. And the turban on her head, it could, if that turban were tight around the head, it could almost be the Virgin. But as you notice, the turban is hanging loose and following the line of the hair. And the look in the eye is very pure and very beautiful, but there's a sadness in it too. You'll be shocked to discover who this person represents in the history of literature. It's the Beatrice Cenci from Shelley's poem and play, The Cenci. Beatrice Cenci is a girl who commits incest with her father. And when we say commits incest with her father, we should really say, well, there's a whole story that lies behind that. What kind of repressive father was it that she committed incest with? Or was it voluntary? Did she wish it? Or did she have to suffer it? These we don't know the answer to. She conspired with her mother to kill her father, and they succeeded. And for this, of course, Beatrice Cenci was put to death herself. It's a terrible story, and it's about the repressive relations between men and women and the revenge that women will take on men and what will happen to the women when the revenge is taken. And suddenly you realize that Mrs. Cameron is presenting this beautiful person partly in the image of the Virgin, partly in the image of the Magdalene, and that we have this combination of a terrible knowledge of life, of sexual knowledge, sinful sexual knowledge, with the purity in the eyes, which is quite devastating. Next, please. Ophelia. this version, with the rosebud at the throat, not open yet, but the darkness of her expression and the way her eyes are lowered, already a type of the Magdalene, because, as you remember in the play of Hamlet, Ophelia has a very bad time with Hamlet. Next, please. I seem to be getting away from my subject, which is heroes, but I shall be coming back to it. I'm getting away from it because I want you to know what the consequences of too much hero worship, too much giving power to authoritarian figures, how that will result in the repression or the subjugation of other people. And this one, you see, is from Tennyson's Idylls of the King, of King Arthur, the poem, the long, long poem that I've referred to as Tennyson's version of the Morte d'Arthur. This is, in fact, another such figure who is suffering from the power of men over her. Next, please. And in this version of some humour and mockery, this is a black and white ink drawing by Georges du Maurier, made at the time that Mrs. Cameron was working, and it shows a kind of parody of the King Arthur story, with Sir Galahad, the one carrying the trumpet, coming down the street, with the woman going before him, who's got all the hair of the Magdalene figure, blowing around her body, as if she's got nothing to wear except this hair. Next, please. Next one. And here is Georges du Maurier in a portrait by Julia Margaret Cameron of Georges du Maurier and his daughter. Now, this is a straight portrait in the sense that I think this is one of the rare occasions when Mrs. Cameron simply made a picture of a friend and his daughter for his sake and for her own pleasure, and with not much more to it. But isn't it strange suddenly to see pictures after the sequence, after this series of images that I've shown you, suddenly a picture of a father with his daughter becomes no longer completely innocent. I'm sure it is innocent. I protest. It is innocent. But suddenly our feelings are somewhat changed because of the context of all these repressive fathers with their daughters. All these men, heroes in their own way, all with daughters as victims. Next, please. I referred in my last lecture to the Moxon Tennyson. That's to say, the poems of Tennyson illustrated by all the great Pre-Raphaelite and other illustrators of the period, which was published by Mr. Moxon in 1853. This is by Sir John Everett Millais, one of the finest of the Pre-Raphaelites, and it illustrates the picture of Mariana in the moated grange. The grange is the farmhouse, and the moat is the water that surrounds it, in the moated grange. Mariana is suffering extremely, as you can see, and her whole body makes this characteristic curve, which Charles Cameron wrote about in his treatise on the sublime and the beautiful, saying that it was like the tree which has the branches that come down to the water, the weeping willow, it's called in English. But this whole idea of the body bent over in this way itself is weeping, and here you have an image of weeping womanhood. Next, please. And in another book of illustrated also by Millais, to illustrate a poem by Coleridge, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the man who wrote Kubla Khan, one of our great romantic poets. This poem is called simply Love. But the relation between the two figures is, I think, really very interesting. The way in which the woman's face is crushed inside the man's shoulder and to the side of his head suggests to me that although this is a romantic view of love, in Judy Margaret Cameron's handling of the subject, the male lover as hero, the idea of the lover as a heroic figure, comes under some small suspicion. Next, please. This is from the Idylls of the King. It's the parting, the moment when Sir Lancelot and Queen Guinevere have to part. Queen Guinevere, of course, is married to King Arthur. And so it's an adulterous relationship. And, of course, it's Queen Guinevere who is in this very weak position, dominated by two men in her life, moving between them, but in this particular picture, shown as really rather weak and passive. Next, please. This is a much subtler picture from my point of view. This is an illustration that Mrs. Cameron did for George Eliot's Adam Bede. Those of you who study English literature will surely study George Eliot sometime, because she is one of our great writers. And it's fascinating to know that Mrs. Cameron wrote to George Eliot and sent her some of her photographs and asked if she could make a portrait of George Eliot. George Eliot refused. And the reasons that she refused was that her companion, the man that she'd lived with all her life and never married, a man called G.H. Lewis, a great German scholar, one of the commercial photographers, I think probably the same man who made Tennyson sitting bolt upright in that chair that I showed you before, rather a stiff pose, that man, called Mayall, had taken a picture of her beloved friend, Mr. Lewis, and she'd never really got over the shock of seeing a man who had so much spirituality transformed into a fixed object sitting rigid like that. So that she didn't trust Mrs. Cameron, George Eliot didn't trust Mrs. Cameron to make her portrait, and so we don't have a portrait of George Eliot by Julia Margaret Cameron. What a tragedy. Because women, of course, can be heroes too, and surely George Eliot is one. The theme of the Sibyls in Mrs. Cameron's work, prophets, yes, male prophets, but Sibyls, yes, female prophets from the classical period. That was her effort to make heroic women, I'm sure. And some other pictures too, but not today. This picture, though, is an illustration from George Eliot's Adam Bede, that other book that Mrs. Cameron gave to Tennyson in 1859. And it's the moment when this couple, in the story, Adam and Hetty, she's called, Adam and Hetty are in precisely that state of tension which all of us who are human will recognize and understand. That's the state where the man is trying to win the woman and the woman is coming towards him and going away again. And just when he is retreating a little, she comes a little way. And just as he comes a little too close, she backs away. It's the old story. But it's a true story. It's much fairer. It has to do with liberty. It has to do with avoiding the subjection of women. And I think Mrs. Cameron gets a much better relation between men and women in this picture than she does in Jephthah and his poor daughter. Next, please. I showed you this before. You see, this is Tennyson. But then suddenly you begin to wonder, is this Tennyson as saint? Tennyson as Saint Anthony? Saint Francis? I almost said San Francisco. No, it's possible, you see. The idea of the saint as hero is now possible to us, but we also know, because we know that Carlyle wrote a book called Past and Present, which had as its great hero the Abbot Samson, he was called. And of course he's called Abbot Samson because Samson himself is a man of great heroic strength. Next, please. And here is indeed Tennyson as the dirty monk, the heroic Samson, a difficult man to deal with, a strong man, quite clearly. Next, please. I've shown you this before, but I keep showing it to you because I like it so much. The Poet as Hero. You see, that was the title of one of Carlyle's lectures, The Poet as Hero. He also had The Poet as Man of Letters, as well as poets effectively, and of course the historians, the heroic historians would be among them. But it is Tennyson, you see, as the hero poet who appeals most of all to Mrs. Cameron. I think it's fair to say that for Carlyle himself, it was the great German poet Goethe. But for Mrs. Tennyson, it's Tennyson. It's for Mrs. Cameron, it's Tennyson. Next, please. This is the painting by George Frederick Watts, which is in the exhibition. And this is the one that I said in my very first lecture, that the Scottish critic said of it that he felt that if it were not irreverent to say so, he would say that it represented the very type of our Lord and Saviour, Jesus Christ. What that meant really was, of course, that the poet now as hero is someone who is a prophet as well. And you soon discover when you read Carlyle's lecture on the poet as hero that he makes the point that in some languages the word prophet, vates in Latin, the word prophet is the same for poet as well. Poet and prophet are interchangeable words in some languages. And so, of course, the relation of the prophet to Christ himself, or Christ is, after all, the supreme prophet. And although I think it is a matter of taste, and not to suggest that Tennyson was Christ on earth again, I'm sure that this is partly the way in which Mrs. Cameron saw him. Next, please. This is the statue of Tennyson by G.F. Watts in Lincoln, up in Lincolnshire, in the east of England. And I put it there for you so that when you go and see that great cathedral at Lincoln, must be our version of Toledo, then when you go there and you see that statue in the garden, you'll remember the time that there was this Englishman who came to Madrid and said, George Frederick Watts and Tennyson and Mrs. Cameron, these are the heroic figures of the Victorian period, and Tennyson here is standing, 10 metres tall in this huge statue by Watts in Lincoln Cathedral, which is the city, of course, from which Tennyson came. Next, please. Browning, the poet, the other poet of the period. Next, please. Here he is again. She tried quite hard with Robert Browning, but I don't think she conveyed anything of the quality that she manages to get from Tennyson. Interestingly enough, G.K. Chesterton, the English writer, said, the trouble with Browning, of course, is that he's the poet as businessman. Whereas Tennyson, oh yes, he's the poet as hero. And it's an interesting thing to think about when you come to study those two English poets. Consider whether G.K. Chesterton is correct. and that in the end, Mrs. Cameron was bound to fail because, in fact, Browning looks best in a business suit. Next, please. You're wondering whether you can recognize this man. Well, it's King Arthur. Yes. King Arthur, the night before the great battle in which he will tragically die, when all his mistakes have been made, and yet his heroic force in binding together the ancient kingdom of Britain, all that has been passed and spent. Here he is, thinking about the day which will follow. When this photograph was published in the Times of London, the Sunday Times of London, in the review of the exhibition, the man who, or the editor who wrote the caption underneath it, made a wonderful mistake. He wrote Tennyson instead of King Arthur. But there's a sense in which he was quite correct. I actually enjoyed this moment very much, and I wasn't laughing at this poor man's expense at all. I was thinking, yes, he's absolutely right. He has seen that there's something in this figure of Tennyson, and I think that you'll agree that those pictures of Tennyson that we've been looking at bear some physical resemblance to the expression in this man's eyes. When I tell you that this man was the railway porter at the Isle of Wight, you'll realize that he was not one of the great poets of English Victorian literature. He was merely the porter who carried your suitcase. But nevertheless, he appears here transformed, transfigured as King Arthur. Next, please. When Tennyson published his popular edition, his edition for the people, cheaply priced, of all his poems, he actually requested that some of Mrs. Cameron's pictures should be used to illustrate the text. Unfortunately, they didn't illustrate them with photographs, but they reverted to the process of the day, which was wood engraving. But nevertheless, I think it is a very remarkable compliment that our greatest poet paid to our greatest photographer, although perhaps Tennyson couldn't have known that himself, or did he? That's the question. Here is the version of the King Arthur that you've seen transformed into a wood engraving in the popular edition, the People's Edition, of Tennyson's poems, 1875. Next, please. This painting I have never seen. It's in New Zealand. I've been to Australia, but I've never yet been to New Zealand. None of us will see it for many years. I find it a very moving and beautiful picture. I've seen it simply as an illustration in a book from which we made this slide. It's quite clearly related, isn't it, to the picture of King Arthur the night before the battle? It's called the eve of peace. Well, the night before the battle, the night before his death, but with his death comes a certain degree of peace. And that picture, that painting, is by George Frederick Watts. And therefore you realize that the relation between George Frederick Watts and Mrs. Cameron was extremely close, and that when he treated such a subject, he too was treating the story of King Arthur, although it's not in the title. This is from the Moxon Tennyson, and it's an illustration in wood engraving form by the man, Daniel MacLeese, who provided the steel engravings for Mrs. Cameron's long translation of Leonora, that German poem which I talked about last time. As a picture, it's a little bit dull, I think. And the reasons that I object to the picture really are because after this basic figure of the woman, which is Guinevere, leading over her dead husband, King Arthur, this is Arthur going to his funeral, we then have
a series of figures, two by two. Two figures here, two figures here, two here, two here, two here, and even twos into the distance. Do you see them? Here and here. All by twos. Next, please. Now, Mrs. Cameron made this version for a book which she called The Idols of the King, and she published it as, in just a few dozen copies, sets of 12 photographs illustrating Idols of the King, the poem by Tennyson, with the text on the opposite page written lithographically in her own handwriting, with the pieces which are interesting for her purposes underlined in her own hand. It's a wonderful thing to see. Her picture, from some points of view, is rather crude. The moon is made of silver paper. The sea is made, rather the river, is made of, the waves are made of sheets from the bed, all crumpled up. But what's really important is the way in which she handles the subject of King Arthur in relation to these three women. There's a fourth woman in darkness here, and even a fifth maybe here. But from our point of view, what strikes us immediately is the three women in white in relation to the king. Next, please. I think if we saw this picture on its own, and you'd been to my first lecture, you would know at once that this was a picture of the three Marys. Three Marys at the entombment of Christ. And the three Marys are in the version which we've just seen of King Arthur with the three women, the three queens. In King Arthur's funeral, they're referred to as the three queens. But the relation of King Arthur now to the three Marys makes, of course, of King Arthur Christ come again to the British people. Christus redivivus. Quite extraordinary idea. I said at the very beginning, didn't I, that typology was about the relation of the Old Testament to the New Testament, comparisons between the two, one relating to the other, the finding of Moses in the bulrushes relating to the birth of Christ in a stable, the saving of Moses, the saving in the stable of Jesus. That typological way of thinking, I said, was extended to include the English poets, and I called it the Anglo-Saxon Testament. Well, you see, King Arthur is the great hero king, the warrior king of the Anglo-Saxon people. And although I'm not here to advertise this as a chauvinistic subject, it's clearly one that Mrs. Cameron was interested in. Next, please. Three figures in relation to the figure who you will recognize instantly as Christ at the Pietà. The relation of King Arthur to the Christ figure is something which I will deal with in my next and final lecture. But what I'm saying now is that this whole idea of the Christ King and the Arthurian King are related in this typology which I've described. This picture, incidentally, is a photograph, a reproduction at the end of the album which belonged to Julia Margaret Cameron's sister. And it appears at the very end of the album, without identification, after a series of Mrs. Cameron's own pictures. Of course, when I found this, it gave me great satisfaction because it made me feel that this picture was being included because it related to Mrs. Cameron's work. And subsequently, I discovered that it's by Fra Bartolomeo. Next, please. The Good Knight from The Idylls of the King, The Good Knight and The Pale Nun, Pale White-Faced Nun. And the text that goes with it shows that the nun considers this crusader knight as her lord and master, in every sense, her saviour. The relation between the figure of the nun and that, the popularity of that subject in Mrs. Cameron's work, I discussed last time in the last lecture. But it shows too that in a way, if the Virgin Mary herself is the first nun there ever was, then the relation of her to the king, which is in the Christian story both her son, but in this context an Arthurian figure, you begin to see the layers of suggestion which Mrs. Cameron places one on top of the other in this rather complex way. Next, please. Holman Hunt's The Light of the World, that's the title of the picture. Christ knocking at the door, knocking at our door, waiting to be let in. You see how the weeds and the flowers are growing over the door, and the door has not been opened for a long time. He comes with his lantern, and his face is illuminated in this way which is very ambiguous, but on the whole, I'm sure, intended to inspire in us a feeling of kindliness and patience. Next, please. This picture I showed in the first lecture and put you all to the test, asking you who it was. Those of you who weren't there can try again and think for yourselves who this could be. I think it's fair to say that this is the moment when Christ is presented by Pontius Pilate, Ecce, as I should say, Ecce Homo. Behold the man. Look at him. And what we see is a figure which takes us all the way back, I think, to that first picture of Carlyle. Not the first, I mean the second. The one where he looks at us and the light covers part of his face. And we said that Carlyle, the man who celebrated the hero in history, was really quite a terrifying figure. This figure is very disturbing, if not terrifying. This is not so kindly. This is more threatening. And there is a kind of terrible authority in his face. Last time we discussed it in terms of Mrs. Cameron's own anxiety once she'd made the picture. How could she present this man as Christ? It's too frightening. And yet, on the other hand, in the light of all those heroes that we've seen that all the heroic figures are men of terrifying authority and power. And I think it's precisely this ambiguity of feeling which makes Mrs. Cameron's work so powerful and so true to our own psychological response, not only to men who are more heroic and cleverer and more intelligent than we are, but also men who are better, morally superior, more courageous than we are too. They become frightening figures as well as figures that we are deeply attracted to. Next one. I think I've taught you my lessons so well by now that you know who this is. It's surely the Mater Dolorosa. And in the typology of the Mater Dolorosa, the curious thing is that she doesn't have to be an old lady. She can be young, like the Virgin is young at the birth of Christ. But she knows from the beginning that her life is one of pain, that she is a woman condemned to be dolorosa. The sorrowful woman. Next one, please. It's Mrs. Cameron herself, taken by her son. No, not exactly dolorosa, not exactly. Not exactly a sibyl, but not far off. Not far off from being either a little bit dolorosa or being a sibyl who can predict the future of the world. I don't have a conclusion. What I say is that the heroic is a subject in Mrs. Cameron's work. The poet as hero, that includes Carlyle, the man of letters as hero. The natural philosopher, Sir John Herschel. Even her dear husband, Charles Cameron, whose pictures I showed last time, the man who was the hero as legislator. Not civil servant, but legislator, the man who founded the University of Calcutta. Because those are heroes too, in their way. And all through her life, I think, there must have been this interesting tension between the idea of liberty, a kind of social equality, an equality between men and women, and on the other hand, a deep desire to worship great men, and that she had these conflicting feelings from the very beginning. I think it's because she became a photographer herself that she should be really the hero of feminist artists. Except, of course, there's an obvious sense in which she was not a feminist at all. She was a traditionalist. She was traditional in the sense that she took the biblical stories and she depicted the Madonna. And we know that, of course, the Madonna is a figure who must always, in a sense, be a suffering person. Can never really assert herself in the way that the male figures of the Bible do. And yet she, this woman, Mrs. Cameron, asserted herself among men in the 1860s and made these pictures in a way that no man could do at all. A profoundly heroic act, I think, in a period when, with one part of her mind, she was perfectly aware of progressive tendencies in societies, and in another part, she was willing to celebrate the authority of great heroic figures. This controversy between John Stuart Mill continued with Matthew Arnold, another English poet who was also a great literary critic. Matthew Arnold is one of our most important literary critics, and he was someone who defended the idea of the tradition against John Stuart Mill. You can have too much liberty, Arnold was saying. What we really need is a few great men who will teach us what is best for us. Well, we know the difficulties of that. And Mrs. Cameron sees this, I think, in her life, and she doesn't really hide from it, but in the end, of course, because she's a profoundly Christian woman, she must give way, I think, to the tradition. My defense of her, having said that, my defense is to say that she transformed the tradition in these marvelously subtle ways, so much so that most people haven't noticed until quite recently. We hadn't noticed that we could have two women as John the Baptist and Jesus Christ. We could have, in John the Baptist and Jesus Christ, we could have Elizabeth and Mary, the mother of Jesus, at the visitation. That this moving between the sexes was something which Mrs. Cameron was prepared to do, and that in her greatest picture, of all, perhaps, the Kiss of Peace, the one that's on the cover. We have a relation of tenderness, a kind of equality, which I think is intended in the story of John the Baptist and Christ. The relation between John the Baptist and Christ is one of extraordinary mutuality. So perhaps there we find the model. When we have two people like that, we have the beginnings of a society, and no longer in the total power of one heroic figure. Thank you very much indeed.